Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is the storm that no one on the Gulf Coast wanted to see. It came anyway. And here's the sound as Hurricane Katrina plowed ashore this morning.
I have never been through nothing like this before, and I'm from New Orleans. Let me tell you, I'm grateful to be here because I didn't want to stay home. I was afraid.
I have a house down here, and my house is already falling apart, and I know my house will not withstand the hurricane.
The wind is so strong, I can barely stand up in it, and visibility is, I mean, you can barely see across the concourse the way it's whipping and blowing.
Everyone says this could be the storm of their lives. Everyone is asking the question, will the levees hold?
Will the levees hold? New Orleans residents and more have been evacuated, their homes and city itself imperiled. Crude oil futures have spiked for the first time to more than $70 a barrel on fear of Gulf and Gulf Coast destruction. The insurance industry is bracing for an onslaught of claims. In a world of crowded coastlines, warming seas, and fierce storms, the stakes are rising. This hour on Point, we go into the eye of Katrina and beyond to look at the global trail of storm surges. You can join the conversation. Have you fled New Orleans for higher ground? And what's the message in the wild winds of Katrina and her sisters around the world? Does something have to give here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We will hear in a few moments, we hope, from the Gulf Coast, where reporters are standing by. But I want to turn first in this hour to Kerry Emanuel. He joins us in Boston. He's professor of meteorology at the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, author of the forthcoming book on hurricanes. It's titled Divine Wind. Kerry Emanuel, thanks for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
We talked just 10 days ago, I guess, Kerry, about what you see as a rising tide of fierce storms. Does Katrina fit into that pattern in your view?
Well, it's very difficult, and I wouldn't go so far as to attribute Katrina to the global increase in storminess that we've seen. The Atlantic is an interesting area that has about 11% of the global total of storms, and it's very strongly affected by natural climate swings that last two decades or so. And we started into an upswing in around 1995. I think people generally recognize that. And I think Katrina is a product of that upswing, but that's a natural cycle.
And Kerry, as you look at this hurricane, you watch hurricanes for a living and pay close attention to them. What do you see here? As someone who knows hurricanes intimately, what's the character of what we see going on the Gulf Coast?
Well, this is the one of the worst-case scenarios. This is the sort of thing that keep forecasters awake at night with nightmares. You had a hurricane that came across Florida. It wasn't terribly strong, but you people listening have certainly familiar with all the damage that it did, even though it was only a Category 1 storm at the time. And it merged into the Gulf of Mexico, and then as it happened, it passed over a series of warm ocean rings where the warm water runs very deep, and we know that that helps hurricanes intensify. It sort of went into an ideal environment for hurricanes, and then it was forecast to turn right up toward New Orleans. And as we're speaking, the western eye wall of Katrina seems to be passing over the eastern side of the city of New Orleans.
And does that mean that New Orleans is still at risk of submersion, or has it dodged the bullet?
Well, it's certainly not out of the woods yet. I think the worst of it is happening right now at this particular time. And I don't have any particular contacts in New Orleans, but the real question is the one that you posed earlier. Are the levees going to hold?
I want to welcome into our conversation from Boulder, Colorado, high above sea level, but watching closely, Roger Pilkey, Jr. He's director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado, author of Hurricanes, Their Nature and Impact on Society. Roger Pilkey, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Your thoughts as you watch this incredible storm churning ashore on the Gulf Coast. Is this the storm everybody feared?
It's very close, if it's not the worst-case scenario. Kerry's exactly right that New Orleans is a fixed target, and the storms come onshore, and it's only by luck that New Orleans hasn't had a direct hit in the last 40 years, and this could be very close to a catastrophic scenario.
And what's the latest you're hearing on the levees, on the waters of Lake Pontchartrain? Of course, New Orleans, a city surrounded by water. Is that risk of submersion still right there?
Oh, I think the risk is there, and I don't think we'll know the extent of the damage until few hours from now when people can get in there and take a good look at what has happened.
We're going to keep close track of what's going on the American Gulf Coast throughout this hour. But Roger Pilkey, you've looked at the entire global situation, and we read the reports from around the world of growing coastal populations and what may or may not be increasingly fierce storms. But the meeting of these two is just proving disastrous again and again and again.
There's an overwhelming trend around the world of people moving to the coast. This is for a number of reasons. People enjoy living by water. It's where a lot of economic activity occurs. It's where our largest cities in the world happen to be. And as people move to the coast, and these are areas that are rapidly developing, the economies are growing, there's more and more infrastructure and more people put into the path of storms. So over decades, as patterns of storms have increased and decreased, we see a steady increase in damages that is pretty much independent of the number of storms. Every time we have a storm, we see more and more damages.
Describe to us what that damage looks like elsewhere. Of course, in New Orleans, we've all seen a population of about 500,000. We're told about 80% of that, an incredible number, evacuated. And still with that, the director of the National Hurricane Center, Max Mayfield, you must know him, saying New Orleans may never be the same after this hit from Katrina. What's the pattern of, let's just begin with evacuations, when storms of this magnitude, destructive magnitude, hit in other low-lying areas of the world, whether it's Bangladesh or you tell us where, along the Central American coast, are there evacuations like we see here? Do people just take it straight on? Do they even know the storms are coming?
Yeah, it's very different in a lot of places of the world than it is in the United States. The United States has a very robust infrastructure for moving people on the interstate highway system, have places to go. In places like Bangladesh, for example, much of the coastal area is low, even under sea level in some areas, and there's no place for people to go. And they've built, in many places, vertical evacuation structures, which are little more than multi-story concrete shelters for people to get above the level of the surge. When Hurricane Mitch came into Central America in 1998, a lot of the damage from that storm was not right on the coast, but inland. And people who lived in mountainous areas saw extreme flooding. And again, no place to go to get away from the storm.
So we may have huge insurance claims out of Katrina's aftermath. We'll be talking with someone from the insurance industry soon. But in terms of the way these mega storms punish the coastlines, New Orleans has a huge physical infrastructure, intense petrochemical industry development there, not to mention what's out at sea. There's a lot of capital along this coastline. When the storm hits in Bangladesh, is it capital or life or both that takes the beating?
Yeah, there's an interesting, I guess, asymmetry in the sort of risk that you see in developing countries versus developed countries. It is true that in Bangladesh, Central America, a lot of the vulnerability has to do with human lives. And there have been several storms that have occurred in the India-Bangladesh region that have claimed more than 100,000 lives. Hurricane Mitch killed more than 10,000 people. And I know folks at the National Hurricane Center here in the United States have a few nightmare scenarios. New Orleans is one of them, also a storm that rapidly approaches the Florida Keys with only one route out of there. There's also concern about storms that intensify very rapidly while people are evacuating from the coast and stuck in their cars, like we saw with Hurricane Floyd a number of years ago.
Remind us of Hurricane Mitch. That hit Central America. What countries took the brunt of that?
Nicaragua and Honduras took most of the damage there. Tremendous infrastructure damage and tremendous loss of life.
And typically when a storm of this magnitude hits that kind of country, what sort of death tolls, what range do we see?
It's not unusual, unfortunately, to see deaths in the thousands. Just last year, Hurricane Jean, which many folks may not remember, went over Haiti and killed upwards of 1,000 people.
Kerry Emanuel, so here we have it, exploding coastal development right around the world, whether it's capital-intensive or not, heavy storms coming ashore. You see a link to global warming and increasing intensity of storms, though we know you're not saying that Katrina individually is necessarily an example of that. But do we have a relationship between humans and the sea, the coastline, that is sustainable here globally?
Well, I think not. I mean, I think we're going to continue to see these terrible disasters. And as Roger pointed out, it really doesn't have much to do with global warming, even if hurricane activity were not changing at all. The real problem is demographic. And it is something that I think people in our country ought to focus on for a while. We get very alarmed at the huge damages that these storms do, and I'm sure Katrina will be up there in the record books. But in other parts of the world, as Roger points out, it's loss of life. And you know, people remember the tsunami and the hundreds of thousands of people who lost their lives, but it wasn't too long before that that in Bangladesh we saw the same scenario. And this is a place where I think people in the developed world could make a difference if we focused our efforts and resources on trying to do things to improve warning and improve ways of evacuating coastal regions. And, of course, also ultimately in the long run to try to discourage people from building lots of structures in vulnerable areas.
Very difficult to do, and nearly 500,000 residents in New Orleans on the move away from the storm in the last 48 hours. Kerry Emanuel at MIT and Roger Pilkey joining us from Boulder, Colorado. Please stand by. We are talking this hour about one big hurricane, Katrina, about the evacuation of New Orleans and the global threat of storm surge. You can join us. Is this nature as usual or something else? And what's the message in Katrina for New Orleans and the rest of the coastal world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Much more to come. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Hurricane Katrina churning ashore on the Gulf Coast, about the evacuation of New Orleans, about the global threat of storm surge. You can join the conversation. Are we pushing the limits of coastal habitation globally? And what can be done about it? That's where the people are. That's where so much industry is. This morning, that's where a huge storm is coming ashore on the Gulf Coast of the USA. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Listeners in New Orleans, what about you? Have you fled New Orleans? Have you fled the coast? What do you see as Hurricane Katrina comes ashore right now? 1-800-423-8255. We're joined this morning from MIT by Kerry Emanuel. He works in the Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences Department there. He's author of the forthcoming book, Divine Wind, on hurricanes. Roger Pilkey is with us from Boulder, Colorado, author of Hurricanes, Their Nature and Impact on Society. And right now, from the Hurricane Insurance Information Center, we're joined by Managing Director Bill Bailey. Mr. Bailey, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
The insurance industry has taken some very heavy blows in the last couple of decades. We've heard about major companies effectively losing the equivalent of all their profits since they were born in this century in recent storms. What do you see developing in Hurricane Katrina?
Well, I think there are two events that have occurred in the last couple of hours that are shedding some rays of hope that the damages ultimately will not be as bad as have been projected for the last couple of days.
Great.
People have been talking about Katrina exceeding the damages from Andrew, and if you convert Andrew's losses into today's dollars, it would be about $21 billion in a single loss. But with the storm winds subsiding slightly, and only slightly, but dropping from Category 5 to Category 4 is certainly movement in the right direction that maybe the damages will not become as catastrophic as people thought. The second factor is that apparently the eye of the storm now has swung slightly more to the east, mm-hmm. and therefore will be going on the east side of New Orleans, which because of the way that the winds and the rain and carried by the winds circulates around the eye, New Orleans may not get the flood problem that they envisioned. I think New Orleans wasn't as concerned about property damage as they were the storm surge. Mm. So those are two very positive signs in the last couple of hours.
But you've got, of course, along this coast, tremendous industrial buildup around the petrochemical industry and in the Gulf itself, all those rigs pumping out the oil. Does the insurance industry look primarily at residential claims as their biggest hit because there are so many homes, or to the industrial sector because the investment there is so deep?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the oil rigs since you brought them up. And the point to be explained right up front is that the oil companies have their own special pool for losses with their rigs because they represent such an enormous investment. And because the possibility of them being severely damaged or destroyed is so difficult to predict because it only happens in very rare circumstances.
So they're not counting on the same insurance companies that keep homeowners afloat?
No. They're going to be handling things on their own. That's what I'm... You know,
okay.
They have their own insurance pool.
Is it the same for the refineries along the coast?
I believe, yes. I think it's called the Energy Insurance Pool or something along that line, but it's an energy industry-based special fund to cover the kinds of losses that occur in the Gulf when you have storms coming up like Ivan. I understand Ivan caused something like $7 billion before everything was paid,
mm-hmm.
to oil rigs and the oil.
We see 14
in our province, so when we make our calculations, we don't put those numbers in there.
Ivan, just last year we see $14.2 billion overall. What about on the areas that the companies you represent do insure? Who picks up the cost when something like this happens? Does it get spread over the entire nation? Do the premiums spike up on the coast?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Not at all.
This is an area that I'm particularly sensitive to because clearly the insurance company that writes your automobile insurance and your home can't charge you and your neighbors and everybody in the state a surcharge to cover losses for homes. Each segment of the insurance market has to support its own pricing mechanisms so that if you are insuring your home, you're looking at the market for homeowners insurance.
But are we sharing the burden with our coastal fellow citizens here or not?
The answer is you're not supposed to be. You're supposed to be writing insurance based upon what you present as a risk. However, through one mechanism called Citizens Insurance Company, it's the property insurance company set up by the state of Florida. Every homeowner in the state can be assessed, and I understand they're going to be assessed somewhere between $5 and $6 each this fall to prop up the $550 million loss that Citizens experienced last year. That's because it's a publicly owned public insurance company and
right.
It handles only the high-risk market.
So spread a little more widely. Roger Pilkey in Boulder, Colorado, explain to us why it matters so much which side of the hurricane hits where? Why is the east side different in its punch from the west of the eye?
Well, the hurricane has a circulation where the winds go around the center of the hurricane. And when the circulation is going in the same direction as the winds from the storm, it puts a little boost to the winds. So on the west side, you have those winds heading in the same direction as the direction of the storm. And adds a little bit of a boost, and you get a correspondingly a little bit larger storm surge. For New Orleans, because it has water on many different sides, it makes a difference whether the water is being pushed towards the city or pushed away from the city.
And Kerry Emanuel, what about the size, I guess the simple breadth of the front of this storm? We're told that that is part of what has distinguished Katrina, a very, very large storm front.
Yeah, and that's right. It's something that we don't emphasize enough about hurricanes is that quite apart from the maximum winds, they come in different sizes. Camille, which was a very strong hurricane, was somewhat smaller, for example.
This is 1969, the last one that hit Louisiana so hard.
And Andrew was a fairly small storm. We don't really understand what makes one large and one small, but it makes a big difference in the damage it does. There's a swath of damage. If the hurricane is twice as big, the damage swath is twice as wide. And it also affects very much the storm surge. If you have a big storm like Katrina, all of things being equal, it'll create more of a storm surge. There's less place for the water to go.
Frank Verostro, do you see any indication, I'm sure insurance companies watch this very closely, that Americans are in any dimension shying away from these vulnerable coastal areas, shying away from moving there, shying away from building bigger homes in the path of such storms? Is there any sign of that? Oh, sorry, I think we've lost Frank Verostro. Excuse me, Bill Bailey.
Yeah, I can answer that for you.
I'm sorry, Bill.
Yeah, the answer is no. In fact, after Hurricane Dennis, they were asking people who had just recently moved to Florida, has Dennis and all the storms last year affected your thinking about moving down here? Are you thinking of going back? And this woman who had moved to Florida just recently from Chicago said, no, anybody who moves down here knows there's a price to pay for living in paradise.
A price
and
to pay.
So paradoxically, what you have is Florida's greatest asset is its lovely weather, and its greatest liability is it's in Hurricane Alley.
And there it sits, and the homeowners pay on the premiums, and the insurance companies paying out.
Well, let me tell you something very interesting going on to put this in a different dimension.
Yeah.
Last year, the average cost of a home in Dade County went up by $25,000. And yet if we had said to somebody, well, you know, we're going to increase your insurance premiums to cover you for this new level of hurricane activity we've seen recently, and we have to be prepared to price it properly, and we're going to raise your rates by $250, people would yelp and scream about the $250, but nobody would mind too much that to buy a house, you'd have to pay $25,000 more to get it.
In the path, potentially, of the next hurricane. Carrie Emanuel, you've looked at the sociology of populations in the storm path, these coastal populations. Let's look at just the social psychology for a moment. Do you have a sense? I know you pay a lot of attention to hurricanes. What about the people in their path? How do they think about this risk, and how do they calculate it into their financial calculations, their mortality calculations?
Well, it's really a question for Roger, but I will say that one of the interesting things about the hurricane risk in the U.S. is something that Mr. Bailey touched on, which is how insurance rates are set. And you have a very complex system where insurance rates are pretty much determined by a state regulator who decides what their rate caps will be. And although I'm not an expert on this, people I talk to say, in effect, we're subsidizing risk. The rates are kept artificially low in high-risk areas like coastlines, and to pay for that, of course, they have to be higher in places where there's less risk. So it's not just a matter of people saying, well, I'm going to move to paradise and take my chances. They're in effect being subsidized for the risk they're taking.
Roger Pilkey, I want to put the same question to you, but we've got a voice right now from the Gulf area where the storm has come ashore. We're joined by Nick Spitzer. He's producer and host of the public radio series American Roots. Terrific show. Nick, are you there?
I am here.
You evacuated New Orleans last night. Where are you now, Nick Spitzer?
I'm with the million people that got out. Yeah, I'm about 110 miles west of New Orleans in Lafayette, the heart of Cajun country, a low-lying area. And we've got fairly high winds here, but nothing like what we're seeing in New Orleans.
How far are you from the coastline there?
Well, the coast is sort of a fluid thing here. To get to the Gulf itself is probably about 30 miles down to the Gulf from here. You know, we're just getting the outer bands of the winds. I have to say, watching, you know, I'm a radio person, but watching
yes.
the pictures, I'm just sick of seeing what's going on in my city. It's terrible.
What are you seeing? What's the latest you're looking
well,
at?
Well, I mean, just the fact that the Superdome roof seems to have been damaged. I mean, that thing was built to last for, you know, like a Roman Colosseum. And
they've got thousands of storm refugees in there.
There's at least 10,000 in the building. My studios are in the French Quarter, and I've heard the levee's been breached there. You know, I have a house uptown. I mean, I just decided to get out for my family, but yesterday in New Orleans was absolute chaos. I mean, you know, people were just scrambling to get out and pulling little laundry carts and trying to get on buses and cars. And, you know, it's not a wealthy city, so you had a lot of people on foot looking for public transit or to get to the dome. And it was really a scary thing. And we've, of course, heard for years what this might be like. And there is a sense of a mixture of joie de vivre meets Catholic fatalism there. And they were stirring up an emotional pot. It was remarkable yesterday, and I can't imagine being hunkered down in the city now. I'm glad I'm not there, but the pictures are very disheartening.
Nick, take us into your own thought process. What was the moment at which it kind of tipped for you, and you said to the family, "We're getting out of here"?
Well, I had hoped. We had actually booked a room in a hotel, thinking, "Well, we'll get in a high rise above the storm." And then overnight, when I heard that it went from a rating of 4 to 5, I said, "You know, these buildings could be compromised, and if this goes badly." If this could be weeks or even months before we can get into the city. And I just said, let's get outside the city and stay near, and then we'll go in if we can, if we're allowed. And, you know, I think when I woke up yesterday morning, I realized, you know, geez, really didn't have the time to do the boarding up I'd have liked to have done. I think most of the city didn't get as boarded as it would have liked. But they got out. People got out quickly in a fairly orderly manner, considering. You know, there's a limited number of bridges out of the city, and if you've seen it but from the air, I mean, New Orleans is a sort of a suppressed soup bowl surrounded by the Gulf of Mexico, Lake Pontchartrain, the Mississippi River. So it's a scary look even in the best of weather.
Nick, are you presuming at this point that we're headed into this submersion scenario? You said the levees breached near the French Quarter, you're hearing. Is that the assumption now that New Orleans...
I don't think it's an absolute assumption. It's too early. You know, the storm's got a ways to go with the progress of the eye, but certainly some of the kinds of things are happening that have been described in the worst-case scenarios, and you know, how far they'll progress and what the you know, vicissitudes of the wind will finally be. I mean, something depends on where the winds are blowing from. If the Lake Pontchartrain side is the tricky side, because you know, a 20-foot wave there is really going to inundate a low part of the backside of the city. And the idea that there's waves coming over or a breach in the levee by the French Quarter, which is the highest ground downtown, it's a shocking thought. I mean, to me.
No doubt.
The television reports are indicating that many homes are flooded up to the ceilings of the first floor, that there's no power and telephone for major portions of the city, and now hotel windows are being reported as blowing out, so that some of the worst fears we've had about New Orleans apparently are being realized, at least initially.
As we speak, Nick Spitzer, New Orleans has been in this spot for a long, long time. The very first settlers there noted the trouble with all that water around. You said the combination of joie de vivre and Catholic fatalism has kept people hanging in there. We've got Carrie Emanuel with us this morning, who has made a link between global warming and more intense storms. There's debate around that. But as New Orleans residents talk about what's going on there and the future of their city, what do you hear? Are people thinking, well, we'll go back, life goes on, or a sense that we're into a new age here?
Well, New Orleanians are notorious about their native sense of the place. I mean, you know, many of them leave and don't want to stay away. They come back. The lifestyle is a sort of a mixture of Caribbean, Mediterranean, Afro-Euro, and you know, it's a place that's given the world jazz, and it's in an unusual place. I mean, the French looked for a little bit of high ground when they plopped down there. You know, water has been a good thing in the sense of being at the mouth of the Mississippi. It was the second largest port in the country before the Civil War, cotton port. It's still very important in oil and petrochemicals. And, you know, it's at a nexus of water, though, and that route in and out is also part of the danger of being there.
And what do you see, Nick? Do you imagine yourself being cut off from that city for weeks, for months, or just no ideas?
That's certainly my fear right now, but I think that life would be pretty miserable there if the bowl fills up, as you know, has in some projections been suggested. You're dealing with, you know, just a muddy, oily soup that doesn't go away because there's too much high water, it can't drain, and you know, you're without power, and you're out, you know, sewerage is backed up, and there's no drinking water. So it's not a very appealing place to be in the aftermath of a storm, worse than other areas where at least the water goes away. So that's one reason I got out. Certainly I'm concerned as a radio and, you know, folklore person about mm-hmm. all my archival tapes and all the things that I've held for years, and you know, you multiply that into people's prized family possessions, and you know, you're in a gigantic mess at this point. But we'll just have to see what happens when the storm passes and what's there. This is an emotional moment for everyone, and we won't know really until the storm moves on what we're facing.
Well, we can well imagine that. Nick Spitzer hunkered down today in Lafayette, Louisiana, far from his home in New Orleans. Nick, thank you for joining us. Good luck there.
Okay, thanks.
And Bill Bailey, Managing Director of the Hurricane Insurance Information Center, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, sir. I just want to report very quickly. There's the second levee breach at Lake Pontchartrain in East New Orleans, and they're reporting the worst of Katrina's winds are now hitting New Orleans proper.
So here we go. Hang on to your hats. Bill Bailey, thanks for being with us. Roger Pilkey, Carrie Emanuel, please stand by. We're talking about one big hurricane, Katrina, hitting New Orleans right now. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about Hurricane Katrina, the evacuation of New Orleans, and the global threat of storm surge. Late-breaking word that the levees we hear, we understand, have broken in a couple places, that the inflow of water has begun. Don't know exactly how serious that is at this moment, but we will be watching. You can join the conversation. What is the message in Katrina for New Orleans, for the Gulf Coast, for the rest of the coastal world as we look at storm surges hitting all over? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amy is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I grew up in New Orleans, and I'm one of nine kids, and I have a family business right on the Mississippi. In New Orleans proper. So I can tell you that couple of points. I don't even think people consider it an option to just move out of New Orleans.
Did you ever evacuate New Orleans growing up there, Amy?
Oh, never, never. Not for Betsy and not for Camille.
Is your family out now, today?
All of them are out, yeah, for the second time in 2 years. So I think it's going to be a new kind of level of thinking, because this is different. This is all things considered, I think New Orleans feels that it's been charmed, and kind of it never hits us.
Somehow defying the odds, but we see the head of the National Hurricane Center saying New Orleans may never be the same. Do you fear that, Amy?
Yeah, it's a really sickening feeling. It's like a jeweled, ship sinking or something. It's just almost unimaginable. And there are a number of close friends who have called, who have not gone to the dome or evacuated, who are, you know, riding it out in their homes. And, these are intelligent people who should kind of know better, and they just won't leave.
Well, let's hope that the worst of it doesn't come to pass. Amy, thanks very much for your call. Let's hear from a couple of officials in Louisiana. Here was New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin this morning with a message for his city.
This is an opportunity in New Orleans for us to come together in a way that we've never come together before. This is a threat that we've never faced before. And if we galvanize and rally around each other, I am sure that we will get through this.
New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin bucking up his city, but of course the storm had not fully borne down on New Orleans yet. Here's Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco from Baton Rouge on the potential damage from the storm.
We've dealt with storms before. We know we're going to lose some property. There will be extensive damage, but we will rebuild. We have confidence in ourselves. We know that we can restore property. We can't restore lives.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Have you fled the storm? What do you see going on along the U.S. Gulf Coast? Today, we're joined by MIT's Carrie Emanuel and University of Colorado's Roger Pilkey, both very close storm watchers. Right now from McLean, Virginia, we're joined by Frank Verastro. He is director of the Energy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, watching the petroleum side of this storm's impact. Frank Verastro, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Good morning.
So here we are. You've got all those offshore rigs in the Gulf. You've got all the refinery capacity on the Gulf Coast. What is the threat to American oil production and oil refining as we look at this storm?
Well, it's a significant threat. I mean, I guess the question at this point is to see what damage has been sustained, and if there is damage, how long it's out. I mean, typically in advance of major storms and hurricanes in the Gulf, and we've seen many, energy producers evacuate the offshore drilling platforms, and the oil tankers that are set to deliver oil supplies to the Louisiana offshore oil port, the Loop, they're diverted just as precautionary measures, and that's precisely what happened yesterday.
Now, we saw oil spike to $70 a barrel in Singapore this morning on anticipation of potential damage for the storm. Do you see higher oil prices coming?
It all depends on what the actual damage is. I mean, when we looked at Hurricane Ivan last year, we lost initially about 1,400,000 barrels per day, which is pretty significant. But over the course of about 6 months, it was down to about 500,000 barrels a day. It was the largest sustained loss of production worldwide. And that's given, you know, the concern about Venezuela and Nigeria and Iraq. So it was significant. It's just not clear. This track of this storm was a little west of where Ivan came, so it's not clear exactly what damage has been sustained by the industry.
Now, if Katrina's already come ashore, and it has, can we assume by that the worst of the danger has already passed those offshore rigs in the Gulf?
In terms of the offshore rigs, that's probably true. Since they were evacuated, it'll be a while before we can get crew boats out to take a look, although I would think that just because of computer modeling, you can find out exactly what has occurred, but that probably won't be later till today. I would say that the bigger concern at this point is probably with respect to refineries in the coastal region from flooding and power outages.
Now, do you have a sense we're told that some of the levees have been breached around New Orleans? We've heard the fear of New Orleans itself being turned into a huge toxic waste dump, in part if chemicals from those facilities should flood into the city. Do you have a sense of the potential environmental damage, never mind the flow of refined petroleum here, if those get severely hit?
Yeah, it could be significant. I mean, the real question is, as your earlier commenter indicated, that if there's nowhere for the water to recede to, that you could be in, you know, up to your waist or higher in oil with submerged tanks over a long period of time. But it's important to find out exactly where the facilities are relative to the breach of the levee.
And what about the global picture? We've been looking at that this morning, Frank. Of course, the Gulf Coast is not the only coast that's been hit. Many coasts hit hard, and much of the world's oil production going on along coasts. Is that a factor in the vulnerability of global energy supplies, the fact that hurricanes whip the seas and are whipping them high lately in the last 10 years?
Well, no, I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, increasingly we're finding in the United States that a lot more of our production is coming out of the Gulf of Mexico, and as technology improves, we're stepping out into the deeper water, in fact, to the ultra-deep water. So you're always going to be subjected to environmental considerations, and the real issue is the severity of the storms. We have seen this year 11 major named storms during this hurricane season, and typically at this time we see three or four. so that should cause concern right there.
We've got Kerry Emanuel with us this morning. He's caused something of a storm himself, linking a more intense hurricanes and typhoons to global warming. You're in a funny position where you look at the oil business, which now depends a lot on calm seas. Do you see a link there? Is the oil industry in a way, you know, soiling its own nest here?
Well, it's an interesting idea. Yeah, but it's not just the oil industry. And in terms of threats to populated areas, we were much more concerned about the demographic tendencies that Roger talked about earlier, and also about natural swings in hurricane activity. But if your time horizon is 50 years and your spatial horizon is global and not just the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic, then we are worried that global warming is, in a sense, coming back to the roost to affect the very industry that partially is responsible
for it. If it begins to take apart refineries on the Gulf Coast or threaten rigs in the Gulf, let's take a call. Nelson's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Nelson. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I simply wondered whether a home can't be constructed at perhaps double the cost that will simply withstand this. Concrete and steel, if you will, or what have you.
That's a good question, Nelson. Thanks for that. Roger Pilkey, what about it? Could we just step up to the risk of storm surges along coasts by stepping up the strength of construction done there?
Well, yes, of course. There are mechanisms of engineering to strengthen homes, but the key point was a word that you used, risk, there. And the cost of fortifying a home can be quite substantial when compared to the risk that it is completely destroyed and the cost of rebuilding it. And this gets to an interesting perspective on hurricanes. Someone could have moved to New Orleans in 1970, purchased a home, paid off their 30-year mortgage, lived there a few more years, then retired to Arizona, and never faced a serious hurricane threat.
Right.
But the real challenge is a societal one, that any time a large hurricane approaches the coast, we know there will be a disaster. So it may be entirely rational for an individual to buy a home, not worry too much about the structure, not even worry about hurricanes too much, because the chances that their home will be destroyed may be fairly small. But if you add up all those risks across the coast, then we find the insurance industry, the government, we all pay for it in that sense. So there's a difference in the risk perception.
So what's the action plan that the society as a whole ought to take away from that? If it might work for any individual, but the costs overall are beginning to get out of hand, what does that suggest in terms of, I don't know, policy?
Well, this gets back to a point that Bill Bailey made when he was on the line, that we have to make sure that the risks that we face are matched by the response. And he made an interesting analogy to the people are willing to pay $25,000 more for a home, but not $250 more for insurance. And this is where policy has to be in place to make sure that the effort that's spent either in fortifying homes, requiring insurance, requiring flood insurance, are matched by the true risk faced by storms. And if we look at the period, say, from 1970 to 1995, that will give us a real misimpression about the true risks that we face in coming decades, because that was a very quiet period and really will lead us to underestimate future risks.
Frank Verastro, what about the oil industry? Can the oil industry infrastructure be hardened to such an extent that it can weather storms like this? And if it were, would the costs drive oil prices up again?
I think it comes back to the whole question of risk and severity of storms and frequency. The infrastructure can be hardened, but it's one of those situations where the increased cost, you're exactly in a situation where if a major event occurs every 2 years, you respond differently than if it's every 50 years.
Frank Verastro at the Center for Strategic and International Studies with the Energy Program. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure, you bet. Thank you.
Laura is calling from Boston. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment about the connection between the hurricanes and global warming.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the hurricanes are an obvious result of global warming, and that we really, as a country and as a world, need to wake up and see that this is kind of nature's way of telling us that we really need to take better care of our Earth.
You know, Laura, the scientists are saying that may be the case, but they're saying it's not obvious necessarily, that there have always been big storms. And even Carrie and Roger joining us this morning, I'm guessing, are on opposite sides of the question of exactly what the connection may be. Well, you've got a gut feeling, or...
I think that the frequency of the hurricane, I mean, there's so many more hurricanes and they're happening so much earlier in the season than we've ever had before. I think it just shows how, you know, the environment is really suffering from global warming and from how, you know, we're abusing it in a sense.
Looks to you like a bill coming due. Laura, thank you for your call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Roger, what about this question? Kerry Emanuel has published what he's published, and it's been debated. How do you look at the global warming storm severity link?
Yeah, I actually think that Kerry and I are probably on the same side of this issue.
Oh, okay.
My research looks at the societal impacts of hurricanes, and one of the things that that gives us is some perspective. If we take a look at all of the storms that struck the United States over the last 100 years, we had a storm that caused the equivalent of $20 billion in damage on average about once every 8 years before 1950. Since that time, we've had only one, and that was Andrew, and maybe Katrina will be the next. But if we look back in time, we saw many, many more powerful storms. That doesn't say that there's no global warming link, but what it does say is that the changes that we see of people moving to the coast, the incredible population growth, we're going to see a doubling in the real cost of these storms every 7 to 15 years simply because of population and wealth. So given that large societal signal, if there is a global warming signal, and Kerry's one of the best researchers out there, and if he says there's one, then I think we should all listen very carefully, it's going to be very hard to identify that in the damage record.
So if you were king of the mountain or king of the coast then, Roger Pilkey, and you see this soup bowl, as Nick Spitzer and others have described it, of New Orleans, sitting below the level of all these surrounding waters, sitting on the Gulf, looking forward, what would you say? We heard the mayor of New Orleans earlier saying, we will pull together, we will come through this. Would you say, no, move north, New Orleanians?
Well, I think that's probably not politically or practically realistic to think that would occur for a lot of reasons. It may not even be desirable. But what disasters do is they open up windows of opportunity for effective change, things that couldn't be done without a disaster. And the first thing that ought to be done when people have a chance to gain some perspective on Katrina is figure out what were the lessons. How can we, as we rush to get back to normal, quote-unquote, where normal is understood as those conditions that maybe led to some undesirable outcomes, how can we change things going forward to improve outcomes the next time we have a hurricane? And New Orleans will certainly see more disasters.
Kerry, shy of abandonment, no one wants to do that. Things like what that might make it better next time around?
Well, I think Roger's hit the nail on the head. We really need to rethink all of the different things that contribute to a disaster like this. There is no such thing as a purely natural disaster. It's always got a man-made component to it. And one of the callers had asked about, for example, building stronger buildings and houses. Well, right now, there's not much incentive to do that because of the regulation of the insurance industry. You're not going to get necessarily a good break on your premiums by doing that. We need to rethink the whole policy toward insurance and who pays for risk. Risk is a complex subject and needs to be thought about much more carefully.
And if we did that, what would the outcome be? Would it make it too expensive to live there? Would it simply spread it across the rest of the nation?
Well, I think in many places it might. I mean, certainly it might make it impractical for new developments to be put down in places that are at risk, even if old established communities like New Orleans remain. There have been previous civilizations that seem to learn that lesson. The Mayans avoided building cities in coastal regions along the Gulf of Mexico because no doubt they had bad experiences. History is full of lessons like that.
Deep history speaking with us today. Well, our hearts go out to all our listeners in Louisiana today, and our hopes that New Orleans will rebuild marvelously. Kerry Emanuel at MIT, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
You're quite welcome.
And Roger Pilkey, Jr. at the University of Colorado, author of Hurricanes, Their Nature and Impact on Society. Thank you for joining us, Roger.
You're welcome.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. And I'd like to end this hour by welcoming listeners in and around the nation's capital, where On Point can now be heard Monday through Friday in Washington, D.C. at 10 a.m. on WETA 90.9 FM. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.